Platt et al. Versus Griffith et al. Daniel A. Carroll, Robert C. Smith, Appellants Counsel. W. Benjamin Pace, Hugh T. Antrim, Michael Montgomery, Jennifer L. Upton, James E. Moore, Joseph T. Pope, Andrew G. Mock, Warren D. Harless, Shannon M. Fitzgerald, Appellees Counsel.
All right, Mr. Carroll, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for possible rebuttal.
All right.
And good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Dan Carroll, appearing here on behalf of Mary Carroll and Lindsay, the two daughters of the late Dr. Lloyd Griffith. And we are asking this Court to recognize their standing to pursue claims against their brother, Charles, a longtime licensed Virginia lawyer, and their stepmother, known as Mary Kate. Their claims challenge conduct that took advantage of their father's dementia and wrongfully deprived them of their vested interests under his will. And specifically, that's the will that has come to be known as the 2010 will, which is found at page 87 of the appendix. Now, as your honors know from the record, the Henrico Circuit Court denied standing on the part of the daughters, concluding that only the personal representative of an estate has standing to pursue claims on its behalf. And of course, that means that standing is the only issue before us this morning. And it came here, of course, on a sustained demurrer, which means that the factual allegations are, for our present purposes, to be taken as true. The important thing to recognize is that the daughters are not here litigating on behalf of the estate, but on their own behalf. And yet the current, and of course it's also important to recognize that the current representative, the personal representative of the estate, is none other than Charles. Yes, the estate would have standing, or has standing, but that's useless in view of Charles's role as administrator CTA of the estate. And it should not eliminate the standing of the daughters to pursue their own claims. As you may know,
counsel,
from the record,
Excuse me, counsel. Yes. This is Justice Chaffin. Did you ever petition the circuit court to have the administrator removed, the brother removed? I realize it's part of your claim here, but did you ever, in a separate petition, ask for one of the daughters to be named or for independent person to be named so that this suit could be brought?
Well, actually, Your Honor, we have a separate suit that's actually pending in Henrico, but we put that on the shelf because of the progress we were making in this suit and also to see what the outcome would be. There's a very different hurdles, in trying to remove someone as a fiduciary, as a personal representative of an estate. And our position is that we should have the right to go directly against this individual in his own capacity and not in the fiduciary capacity, or in both capacities, depending on the circumstances. But that is a very difficult hurdle sometimes, and raises all sorts of other questions, which we may end up touching on as this case proceeds.
Also, you did not name, can you tell us why you failed to name the estate in this claim rather than just naming the brother and the widow?
Well, the estate is really not the, is not the cause of the problem. It is the brother and the stepmother acting individually. And that's where all the problems arise in this case. So there was no need to list the estate. Now, under the will, it's important to just keep in mind, just for context, that there are two major classes of assets that are involved here: real estate, consisting of two 20-acre parcels worth about $1 million each. And then we have personal property that is also measured in millions. At real estate, by virtue of a deed of gift in 2014, the real estate was moved, the 20 acres were taken away, if you will, from the daughters. And this was a deed that was signed by Dr. Griffith in the immediate wake of some surgery under which he was under anesthesia, which he was just coming out of.
Mr. Carroll, 2 years later, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a brief question. Can you help me with this idea? I'm having a difficult time conceptually understanding how a beneficiary could have a vested property interest in an asset that the doctrine of ademption has taken out of the probate estate prior to the decedent's death. I mean, I don't see the logic there. I don't know why the doctrine of ademption doesn't necessarily mean there can't be a vested interest. Putting aside all the who shot John about dementia and who coerced whom, just that one conceptual problem. Can you work that through with me?
Well, thank you, Justice Kelsey. That point was made by the appellees of redemption. So, but the point that is missing here is that redemptions would work, if you will, if it were not for the fact that the transfer were, and of course we have to prove this, but right now allegedly wrongful transfer. If the estate is emptied of its assets before the interest of a beneficiary vests, then yes, if those assets are emptied lawfully, there is of course no assets left to be distributed to the beneficiary.
Well, I'm not familiar and educate me on how it is that we can go into a contest like that and say, okay, I see on the face of it, ademption has occurred, but I don't think it should have occurred. Ademption should not have occurred here because the asset should not have been transferred, and I can go underneath the earlier pre-death transfers and challenge the legitimacy of that. Is that concept, you know, going behind ademption, is that concept something that's recognized generally across the United States? Because when I was reading the briefs, I was very much interested to find out if anyone would show me some treatise discussions of this to make this point, and I didn't see that, and I did a little research on my own, and I still don't see it.
Well, Your Honor, it's a matter of logic, of trying to have the legal system provide a means of a remedy, a remedy that will work for one who's been wrongfully deprived of property.
Why isn't Justice Chafin's remedy the remedy that would be ordinarily used? You go to the chancellor and you say, you know what, the bad guy, according to you, is actually the personal representative. We need to move him out, bring someone else's objective in, let them look at the facts. And maybe the new curator or the new personal representative looks at the facts and says, you know what, Mr. Carroll's right. I want to file this suit. Or the new representative says to the chancellor, I don't see the facts sufficient to get these people in litigation for 5 years and spend millions of dollars fighting over it. Why wouldn't that be the right way the law would treat this problem?
Well you may have put your finger on the very issue here, and that is that how can we assume that the estate is going to have the financial wherewithal to pursue litigation that may end up being protracted and expensive? The estate may not have the resources to do that. And furthermore, I must ask why the law should require the beneficiary to be represented by a third party, not of her own choosing. Why should the law require that, prohibit her from choosing her own legal counsel to seek her own legal redress? And again, once she has that vested interest, she's the party that's actually been injured. The estate has not been injured. The administrator has not been injured. Think about an example here where if you have a testator who has been injured by, let's say, an automobile accident, and maybe even injured or even killed. Well, it's logic that the personal representative would stand in the shoes of that testator and seek redress for that accident, assuming that accident was by someone outside the confines of the estate, in other words, a third party. But where you have a dispute that's within, if you will, the confines of the estate, it's a very different position that you put the personal representative in. Because at that point, unlike unlike the parallel of the automobile accident, in the case where there's been a wrongful transfer, that's not affected the testator in the same way. Because by the time that wrongful transfer could be pursued and a remedy sought, the testator himself has not been injured because he can hardly be injured by an asset that's been transferred, which he was going to give away anyway. And so the only injured party here is the beneficiary, not the
estate. All right, so let me ask one more hypothetical. I'm following what you're saying. Suppose, change completely the context. Suppose I agree to sell you my car, and it's a flat-out agreement. You pay me up front for the car even, and someone else steals the car before I can deliver it to you. Would you be able to sue the person that stole the car? Now, you could sue me because I don't deliver the car to you, even though it's not my fault, but you paid for it, you get your money back. But you have a super vested interest in that contract to get the car, but some thief takes it from me. Would you be able to sue that guy?
Well, I think that there's some differences here between the contractual setting and the estate setting.
Well, because the actual difference to me is that in a contractual setting, you got a really high interest, you, the buyer. You paid the money, you're vested out the wazoo into the interest in that car, but some third party steals it from me. Now, would you be able to sue that guy?
I would argue that you could. Why not? I mean, because again, you've been in your example that we're talking about the injured party, and we're talking about providing an injured party with a remedy. And if we go down the road that the appellees want to travel, we run the risk of having an injured party that has no remedy. And so,
Mr. Carroll, you have 2 minutes and 34 seconds left. You may use your time any way you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'm going to go ahead and just reserve that unless Justice Kelsey has a follow-up.
No, I'm fine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. The appellees have chosen to split their time. Mr. Antrim, you're first. You have 7 minutes on the clock.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chance. That Charles Taylor Griffith, one of the two appellees in this matter. I have read Mr. Carroll's brief and reply brief and listened intently to his argument. I have practiced in this area of the law for a long time, and I confess to being a little confused about where we are. He makes the point that the daughters have a right to litigate on their own behalf. I don't really know what that means. The case before the court is all about rescinding what is called a chattel deed and a deed of gift to real estate. Rescission of those documents is in the prayer for relief for each of the 7 counts of the complaint. That has got to mean that the idea is to restore personality and real estate to the probate estate. Or are they asking something else? Are they asking to sue for money damages? I don't think there's any basis for that. Each count in the complaint sounds fraud perpetrated on Dr. Griffith during his lifetime. If he were still alive, the appellants could not sue on his behalf, I submit. But he's not alive, so the cause of action now personal representative. Several times it's been said, well, Charles Griffith is he's not going to sue himself. Okay, he's not. But the trial court early on invited the appellants to bring on a motion to remove the administrator CTA, but for whatever reason, at that point in time, they chose a different strategic path. They chose the path what they call vested beneficiaries. Although to my way of thinking, real estate, tangible personal property need to be restored to the estate before they can be vested in anything. Are the appellants arguing that they have a personal cause of action to have would-be testamentary gifts transferred directly to them and not the estate? Otherwise, I don't understand the concession Mr. Carroll made in his brief, quote, Mary Carroll and Lindsay agree with the Renick and Burns cases, two cases we cited in our brief. Quoting further, a personal representative is a proper party to litigate on behalf of the estate, but the daughters are not here on Dr. Griffith's estate. They are here as vested beneficiaries on the 2010 will. Now, we have a statutory construct, the administration of estates, and it generally works pretty well. It's been in place for a very long time. The rules are very well established. If beneficiaries are given a personal cause of action to go after assets to which they believe are entitled in good faith or bad faith, what happens to creditor protection? What happens to the claimants under Section 4.2-528 of the Code if an estate happened to be insolvent? Let's go back to the basic proposition. It is alleged that fraud was perpetrated upon Dr. Griffith during his lifetime. Am I not right, therefore, that the claim of redress then belonged to Dr. Griffith and Dr. Griffith alone while living? Were he still alive but incapacitated, the claim would succeed to his duly appointed and qualified conservator, or maybe an attorney in fact? And in the event of intervening death, the claim would then belong to his personal representative. I mean, that's been Hornbook law for a very long time. You go to Mickey's jurisprudence and you hear the cites of cases, the Burns case, which we cited. The personal representative, not a beneficiary of the estate, is the proper party to litigate on behalf of the estate. Case, NCAACP, labor. Under Virginia law, the personal representative, either the executive or the administrator, is the proper party to litigate on behalf of the decedent's estate. Finally, the Rennick case. The Supreme Court of Virginia has declined to blur the lines between a suit brought by a personal representative and a suit initiated by a beneficiary of the estate. The Supreme Court has noted that the personal representative, not a beneficiary of the estate, is the proper party to litigate on behalf of the estate. And duly noted, counsel for the appellants say they agree with the Burns and Rennick cases. But they say we're not here on behalf of the estate, we're here as vested beneficiaries. The notion of vested beneficiaries and non-probate assets is simply beyond my understanding of what the law allows. Finally, appellants state, quote, at this stage of the case on a demur, edge facts must be taken as true. Thus, Dr. Griffith's estate is deemed to include the asset that had been wrongfully transferred, including those intended for his daughters. But Charles Griffith did not file a demur. He filed a motion to dismiss on the basis of standing, just standing. On that basis, the complaint against Charles Griffith was dismissed. On that basis. Case law tells me that on a motion to dismiss for lack of standing, the relevant facts on the table are those pled, the relevant facts, assuming there's no evidence taken. I submit that the only relevant fact is that the appellants do not serve as personal representatives under Dr. Griffith's estate, because the only issue before the trial court was standing. I further submit that the appellant's counsel is flatly wrong to say Dr. Griffith's estate is deemed to include wrongfully transferred assets prior to his death. The alleged wrongful transfer is not to be taken as true on a motion to dismiss for lack of standing. They could have and should have moved to remove Charles Griffith as administrator of CTA if they were serious about pursuing this claim. They did not. The trial court committed no error. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. The clerk will put 8 minutes on the clock for Mr. Pace.
May it please the court, Ben Pace of Williams Mullen for the Mary Kate Griffith. And I submit this case represents the perfect example of why Virginia law limits standing to sue on behalf of an estate, and specifically on behalf of a decedent who allegedly suffered some wrong during their lifetime, to the personal representative of that decedent's estate. The appellants here are the estranged daughters of Dr. Griffith. Dr. had two well-established priorities for his estate plan, that his wife Mary Kate would be well taken care of, and that his son would inherit Albany Farm, his farm in the northern neck of Virginia. He told his attorneys
any law professors arguing for it? I'm struggling to understand the logic of that. But if it's out there, I want you to tell me.
No, Justice Kelsey, I was unable to find anything along those lines. And in fact, that's why in my brief, I focused on the well-accepted principles of ademption, and that gifts, bequests to legatees, especially specific bequests, like in this case, two parcels of real estate, they're extinguished if the decedent has alienated the property. If the property is no longer in his estate when he passes away, those gifts are extinguished. And as the courts have said in the cases that I cited, that means the rights of the potential beneficiaries have been extinguished, and those legatees no longer have legal rights relating to those assets. The cases that...
So, counsel, even if there's coercion or fraud, they're completely out of luck? Or is your point that to the extent they want to make those claims, they have to take a different path by stepping in some way in the shoes of the estate?
Yes, exactly. And that's the point we've made in our briefs, and it's the point that makes good sense as a policy of the Commonwealth of Virginia. As Justice Kelsey alluded to in his questioning of Mr. Carroll, shouldn't the personal representative of the estate, which very often in estates that have significant value is an executor, whom the testator has named as the person he wants to administer his estate, or the personal representative that's been appointed by the clerk, shouldn't that be the person to decide what claims to pursue on behalf of an estate? And if there is a dispute like this one, where disappointed relatives, disappointed potential beneficiaries are upset, shouldn't the court also be a gatekeeper to say, do I need to remove a personal representative and replace them so that a suit may be pursued?
Can you educate me on how this would work? Suppose the substitute curator or the substitute personal representative says, I just don't know what to do on following up on these allegations of the potential beneficiaries. Would it be appropriate for the personal representative in that context to go to the chancellor and say, on an aid and guidance request, here's the evidence I'm seeing, we can take evidence inter vivos by voice, or we can have it on affidavit, but give me guidance, judge, on what you think I should do?
Absolutely. It absolutely could work that way. In fact, you've got a spectrum of options under Virginia law, and we've already gone through many of the options. This very situation, a suit for aid and guidance was filed to say, Your Honor, we have a will. Looks like a will, talks like a will, appears to be a will. This could be the actual will of Dr. Griffith. And by the way, the appellants in this case challenged the 2010 will that they're now saying they want to enforce as being the product of undue influence, fraud, and executed when Dr. Griffith lacked capacity. We had a trial on that where Judge Marshall heard the evidence that is part of this record that exactly what Dr. Griffith intended was carried out through the subject deeds of gift, and that he, in fact, had an estate plan related to those deeds of gift. And I will also point out that that the appellants here filed a petition to remove Charles as administrator simultaneously along the same time frame as the 2010 will trial, that proceeding. And they also filed a suit to attempt to rescind these deeds. Those were put on hold because the 2010 will was going to dispose of the property in an almost identical way as the deeds of gift. And
other than the 20 acres, excuse me, this is Justice Goodwin, it was going to dispose of the property similar, other than the 20-acre parcels to the daughters, right?
That is all that they have left to pursue under the 10th.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And that's what they are pursuing.
That they're attempting to pursue, correct.
Right.
20-acre parcels. However, as Justice Kelsey has pointed out, those gifts extinguish through redemption, and it should be left to the personal representative to make that call. And that's especially important in the context of the discussion we've been having of shouldn't the personal representative or the court, through a petition to remove that personal representative, decide whether it's worthwhile to pursue claims. And these would be protracted.
Let me just ask you this, because I think I know where you're going with that. And it comes back to the question of what if the personal representative just decides, you know, this money's not coming to the estate anyway, and I really don't care who gets it, so I'm just not going to pursue it. Maybe the guy had dementia and he didn't mean to give it away, but it doesn't matter because the estate wouldn't get it anyway. So as the administrator, I'm not going to pursue this. I'm not going to put money into this because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't help the estate any. What does a beneficiary do in that situation?
Well, Your Honor, in that situation, I would say that the beneficiary has to exhaust their remedy. It could ask the court to hear evidence on its due parade guidance as someone who's potentially interested in the estate as a potential beneficiary of the estate. They've already been heard in a day-long trial on claims that the 2010 will was a product of fraud and undue. And
correct.
So
and now they want to be heard on the gift.
I'm sorry?
And now they want to be heard concerning whether or not the gift was the result of undue influence, is my understanding of what this is all about. It's not about the 2010 will. That's been resolved.
I believe that's correct, but we're in a situation where beneficiaries have filed a 53-page complaint. They've a potential beneficiary. They've alleged, among other things, breach of fiduciary duty against their brother because he happened to be a lawyer, statutory business conspiracy.
Can I stop you right there? Because I know what has happened. I mean, we've all read the pleading, so I know that's what they did. So I don't see that that's really relevant.
Well, it's relevant for a judge and for a personal representative in assessing whether to allow claims to go forward when fisheries are not proper parties. It's, you know, when you observe irrational acts by litigants who are attempting to pursue claims, and you've already heard evidence from attorneys who assisted someone with their estate plan that his wishes have been carried out.
Can I stop you right there? Because this is where the disconnect comes in for me, because the gift abrogated the estate plan that he had put in place. See, that's where the disconnect comes from for me, because you keep saying, well, we've already had a trial on what he wanted to happen to his estate through his will, and that's true, and that's happened. But the question now is, after that will was put into place, something happened to disrupt the plan that evidently Dr. Charles Griffin wanted to be in place. Not Dr. Charles Griffin, but Dr. Griffin.
I understand your question, but only as to those two 20-acre parcels.
Correct. And that's what it boils down to.
Right. And my simple position is that that should be the representative of the court representative call whether that claim is something that there's sufficient ground.
Justice Goodman, has he answered your question?
He has. Thank you.
All right. Your time has expired. Mr. Carroll, do you have rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. And I think Justice Goodwin has put his finger on the heart of this case. I heard Mr. Pace admit that the way this redemption theory would unfold could leave the injured party without a remedy. And I can't believe that the law should work that way. Regardless of whether
there's been
precedent.
Mr. Carroll, this is Justice Kelsey. I get your sympathetic argument, but what's the authority for it? If it's so clear that after an indemption, any party that could win absent an indemption can just sue people, then there would be authority somewhere in the United States for that. And there may be a lot of it that I haven't seen. Because someone would be citing Bogart, someone would be citing the treatises, someone would be citing cases. But I haven't seen a single case directly saying what you're saying.
Well, sometimes, Your Honor, we have to clarify the law. And if the law has taken us in a direction that ultimately makes little sense logically or otherwise, or we need to take steps in the other direction. What the indemption theory, indemption argument leaves us with, it would have seemed to me, is that an estate could wrongfully be drained of all of its assets. And if that's the case, given the indemption argument, then not even the personal representative would have standing to pursue the wrongdoer. Everything's gone.
I think the one person we're not talking about in this discussion is the chancellor. These cases are not happening in some vacuum somewhere. A chancellor with a commissioner in chancery is overseeing this whole thing.
And I
imagine the worst case scenarios that are being conjured. If I were back on the trial court bench and I was the chancellor presiding over this probate estate, I'd bring the issues in, and I'm confident the average circuit court judge would, if it were as egregious as we're hypothesizing.
But once again, it is somebody that's outside the confines of the estate, someone who has not been chosen by the injured party. And in the final analysis, we run the risk of having, as Mr. Pace has admitted, having the injured beneficiary without a remedy. And upon the closing of an estate that fails to distribute what is rightly due to a beneficiary, the theory in effect would even cause the relevant court to, in one sense, be contributing to the wrongdoing. And so
with the Chief Justice's permission, may I ask one more question, Chief?
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
My last question, Mr. Carroll, but if I'm a chancellor presiding over a probate dispute like this, and I see that a personal representative is just deep-sixing an obvious claim of fraud, don't you think that I or any other circuit court judge would put somebody else in that position and take care of the problem?
Well, it may well be that someone else would be put in that position, Your Honor. However, again, as I mentioned earlier, that assumes that the estate has the assets to litigate in whatever manner it must be that the case calls for. And that's a problem. And that's why when we get to the final analysis of standing, we talk about an injured party. The only injured party here, ultimately, is the beneficiary. And again, recognizing that that beneficiary must have an interest that's vested, that the redemption could remove things while the testator's alive. But once the testator has died, the testator has no interest in that property because that property has been determined to be distributed under the testator's will. And so,
okay,
again,
thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you so much, Mr. Carroll.
Thank you, Your Honor, for your question.
All right, your time has expired, Mr. Carroll.